Today I'm going to plan on finishing up the Ten Commandments. And we're going to look at the last five. Last Sunday we did the command to honor your parents and tied it in with Father's Day. The Sunday before that we did the first four. The first four commandments, can anyone tell me what they relate to?
God.
How we relate to God, more specifically. And then the last six are how man relates to man. People relate to people. And that's all the review I plan on doing this morning. And someone asked me earlier, they missed the message. Can we? Yes, you can listen to the messages at the website, which actually we need to change our website, the bulletin. It's now, there's no www before it anymore. My brother's changed that this week, so now it's just bbccv.org, but it's in the bulletin. So you really need to get the context of this. I'm not going to go back into Exodus chapter 20 and go back over all the stuff we've looked at so far, but I think it's important to understand that. We're actually going to be looking at the last five commandments through the lens of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. So, though the message is on the Ten Commandments, I want you to open to Matthew chapter 5 this morning, not Exodus chapter 20, but Matthew 5. We're going to look at what Jesus said about the Ten Commandments, and especially the last five. Matthew 5 is a fitting reflection of Exodus, actually 19 through 24, because Matthew, in his original audience, he was directing his gospel towards Jews, primarily. And so as he wrote this account of the Sermon on the Mount, it would have been very obvious to his Jewish readers the similarities to Mount Sinai and what when Moses gave the law at Mount Sinai. And so there's this, as Matthew paints this picture of Jesus on the mountainside and goes through all the teaching that Jesus is doing, the original readers would have very quickly picked up on the idea that this is just like Moses at Mount Sinai. And so we too are going to follow that same idea, the same picture. I want you to have that picture in your mind, that same picture we've been looking at in Exodus. Mount Sinai, right? The mountains shaking, and there's thunder, and there's lightning, and there's trumpets blowing, and they hear the voice of God, and all these amazing things that they're watching. Now we're in Matthew chapter 5. We have Jesus on the side of a mountain, sitting down, talking to this great crowd that were following him. Matthew places us at the very beginning of his gospel account. In the passage before this, Jesus had called his disciples to follow him. And then he began going around Galilee, teaching in the synagogues and healing people and casting out demons and all these amazing things. And Matthew says that great crowds were following Jesus from all over the area. Matthew chapter 5, verse 1, we pick it up now. So Jesus, seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, His disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth, and he taught them. So that's the scene, that's the background. Jesus has got these great crowds that have been following, they're on the mountainside. He sits down, and he begins to teach them. So keep in mind now, again, the reflection here. Jesus on the mountainside, Moses at the foot of Mount Sinai. Moses also had a large crowd following him, much larger than the one Jesus had following him. Moses, we've said before, the people coming out of Egypt, the Israelites, were probably numbering 2 to 3 million people. So undoubtedly, Moses' crowd was much larger than Jesus' crowd. If there was 2 to 3 million Jews following Jesus, Rome would have certainly taken note of that. So Moses had a larger crowd, and Moses' crowd, the Israelites, had also seen some pretty amazing things besides what they're seeing right now with Mount Sinai. They had seen God's provision of water from a rock. They'd seen the Red Sea split. They'd seen all these plagues befall the Egyptians. They had seen God's hand in powerful ways. They had seen God. at least his hand. So had the Israelites who were following Jesus. They had seen these miracles, the demons being cast out. They had heard Jesus' teaching. They knew there was something special about this guy. And so here they were on the mountainside. They listened intently. Just as the Israelites had listened to Moses, these crowds around Jesus are listening intently, hanging on his every word. So Matthew painted for his original readers a picture of Jesus, very similar to Moses. And finally he puts Jesus on this mountainside to teach them. And the earliest readers would not have missed the connection to Moses and Mount Sinai, and neither should we. There's also many parallels in terms of the structure of the law given in Exodus that the earliest readers would have quickly noticed. That's why I want to emphasize the need to go back and listen to the messages we've been going through in Exodus chapter 20, just to kind of get a feel for what's going on. If you've missed them or if you've forgotten them, go back and listen to those. So in Jesus' prologue to the New Covenant, if you will, he laid out some new information that was counter to what even the more devoted Jews would have done and thought. He declared in his blessed, blessed are the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, peacemakers, those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, and those who are reviled, persecuted, and spoken falsely against for Jesus' sake. These are words of promise, yes, but the blessings would come through suffering, which perhaps is why the crowd was so receptive to it, because they were suffering. They were under Roman rule. Certainly, they felt like they needed to be freed from that. And so when Jesus comes to them and says, blessed are you when you're going through all these things and all these things are happening to you, and blessed is the peacemaker, and blessed are all these things, they're eating this up because they're identifying with this. We are these people. We are in this position. And he's saying, blessed are we. So he promises a blessing for those who are oppressed for the name and sake of Jesus, their Lord. He also told them that they were the salt of the earth and the light of the world, and they were to be visible to the world and busy about service in the name of God, so that the watching world would see something different and they would be pointed to God by what was going on in the lives of his followers. Now there are parallels in as much as both the Israelites at Mount Sinai in Exodus 20 and the followers of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5 were being given a standard that would serve as a testimony to the watching world that something was different, something better, something that only God, the one true God, could possibly put together. This teaching that Jesus was proclaiming, just like the teaching that Moses had proclaimed, it was different. It was completely unheard of at that time. Now, Jesus was speaking mostly to Jews who were following, supposedly, the Ten Commandments. They at least knew them. They knew the law, knew about the law. And even at that, this was going to be totally revolutionary even for them. Just as what Moses gave the Israelites at Mount Sinai was revolutionary for them. Now, it may have been difficult for us to imagine the Israelites at Mount Sinai being astonished by that new standard that God was giving them. Because, you know, the Ten Commandments, it seems pretty basic to us. But I don't think it's hard to imagine what Jesus gave his audience on the Sermon on the Mount would have been a whole new thing and difficult to stomach almost. Especially as we look at it today, because even some of the things that he says in there today, even for us, we might go, whoa, 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 wait a minute, I'm not sure about this. And so it should be easier for us to be able to say, wow, this is new stuff here that Jesus is presenting. Matthew says of the audience that Jesus spoke to, he doesn't give a commentary on how they thought about that, but he does say that they were astonished by his teaching. And in spite of that, or maybe because of that, the word astonished means to be struck with amazement. They're amazed at what Jesus is saying. In the next verse of chapter 8, right after this, says, when he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. So they weren't scared away by what Jesus said. In fact, they followed him even more. Jesus, remember, was speaking to those who would follow him. So his Sermon on the Mount is directed to those who are following him. It's not going to be the standard for pagan cultures. This was going to be the standard for those who would follow him. And it was going to be the standard from that day through to this day on until he comes back. This is the new standard. The Mosaic Law recorded in Exodus established a moral code and a government for a nation living as God's chosen people. So by virtue of that, it also had to cover issues arising from those living in that nation who may not have been true believers. And that's going to be an important thing to remember. I'll probably bring that up again next week, because as you get a little further into Exodus, some of the things that are in there, we just go, what in the world? What is this doing here? Well, if God is speaking in Exodus to a nation composed mostly of believers, but unbelievers as well, there's going to be a little bit different aspect brought out of it, as opposed to Jesus now is talking to those who are going to follow him. And so it's going to be important to bear that in mind, again, as we get back into Exodus next week. But what Jesus says reveals the motives of the heart. And this is where his focus is for his followers. Where is your heart? These are going to be the standards by which his followers were to live even till through today. And as we'll see, they go further than the law as revealed in Exodus. That's why Jesus said he hadn't come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. Jesus was the only person in all of history to live to the standard of the law, both in practice and in spirit. He most certainly fulfilled the law in that sense. Which is why, read verse 17 with me now. Jesus, he's spoken some now, but he gets to verse 17. He says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." So in this little passage, Jesus makes a little jibe at the scribes and Pharisees. Your righteousness, he says, must exceed that of them if you're going to enter the kingdom of heaven. The scribes and Pharisees were masters at following the letter of the law. That being said, where they couldn't follow the letter of the law, they just reworked it so they could. That's what they did. And they had spent centuries doing this, decades at least doing this, and they had developed a whole system that had effectively replaced and usurped every little iota and jot and tittle of God's law. They had already done away with God's law by the time Jesus comes on the scene. And so they've already done away with that. They had essentially made God's law null and void. It would be helpful to briefly point out the irony Jesus was giving here with the term of the Greek iota. It's also translated in some translations as jot. That's how I grew up, jot and tittle, not iota and dot. If you're King James people, jot and tittle is what you're used to hearing. But iota was a Greek letter corresponding to the Hebrew letter jod. It was a small letter. But more importantly, it was a letter that the author could, at his discretion, leave out or put in, and it wouldn't change the meaning of the word. So it wasn't really that important of a letter, it would seem. The dot, or the tittle, was a point or a small line used to distinguish one letter of the Hebrew alphabet from another. So these were tiny little things. But Jesus says not one of them is going to pass away. So the irony is that the Pharisees and scribes had redone the whole law. They hadn't just gotten rid of the little dots and tittles. They'd gotten rid of it all and started over. They had reinterpreted the scriptures. Sound familiar? We say, well, we stand in shock that's happening in the church today, but the reality of it is it's nothing new. Paul addressed it in his gospel or in his epistles. He addressed it. It was already going on in the first century. This idea that we can rewrite, reinterpret, and replace God's word. So Jesus was about to fulfill the scriptures, and indeed was in the process of doing just that. The moral standards and codes of conduct described by God's law weren't being removed. Righteousness exceeding that of the scribes and Pharisees went beyond mere actions. These guys had mastered the art of deception, whereby they thought they could appear to obey God while having hearts that were far from Him. Of course, I don't think very many people were really fooled by them. They may have thought that they had fooled people. I don't think people were that impressed. Some might have been, but for the most part, they weren't. Jesus was going to remove all possibility of this as He revealed not just the evil deeds the law addressed, but also the evil hearts that were the real problem being addressed by the law. Jesus' teaching on the Mount amplified the common moral codes of the Jews of His day. Now, I use the word amplified here to emphasize that He took them and He expanded them beyond what anybody might have thought. He addressed some of the standards of living laid out in the Ten Commandments. He also addressed some that were addressed in the other laws of the Old Testament, the Torah. And He talked about things that were commonly practiced by the Pharisees that had become a major source of hypocrisy for them. So these are the three things that he addresses in the Sermon on the Mount, these three broad categories of things. And since our main interest is in the Ten Commandments this morning, and especially the last five, we're not going to address everything this morning. We're going to start with the one the ESV Bible gives the heading, anger. Chapter 5, verse 21. You've heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who's angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift." Now, did you catch that? Jesus just basically put all of us on the hot seat as being guilty of crimes, he says, equivalent to murder. Anybody in here being convicted of murder? Probably wouldn't admit it if you had. No, we're all okay on this one. When we come to the Ten Commandments and we see "thou shalt not murder," we're good. We're okay on this one. I'm not as bad as those people because they killed somebody. And Jesus comes along and He says, "You know what? Let me tell you what this means." He listed being angry with your brother. Now, we're not just talking about your siblings here. Of course, we don't use the term brother as much perhaps in this church. But brother typically is referring to someone within the family of God. Brother or sister. So if you've been angry with your brother, Jesus said that's equivalent with murder. Now we can see where we're all kind of in a little bit of trouble here. He also says, whoever insults his brother or calls him a fool or an empty head. I said calling a brother a vile name. We can see the issue goes way beyond the physical act and gets to the heart of people at odds with one another. The sin starts in the heart. So we're at the first one, and we're in trouble, aren't we? Every single one of us in this room is in trouble because we're guilty of this. Jesus has raised the standard considerably. This is not just murder in the physical sense. This is anger, bitterness that rises up within us upon which we act without actually killing anybody. We're still guilty, he says.